Your face is shaped like a heart. He then gently traced his thumbs around my face as I snickered. I couldn't get home fast enough to study my reflection in the bathroom mirror. Could I be cute? I thought, as nappy-headed nigger memories reeled through my head. What's he talking about, a heart? I didn't see any such shape. Yet there was no mistaking the flurry of monarchs flapping inside me when I was with him. I told no one about our budding romance, if it can be called that. We never even held hands or kissed, but Horace was the first boy who made me feel like I might be attractive, just maybe. I also fell for his brilliance. In those years, I was an admirer of the mind. That is true even now. If you can tell me something I don't know, you've got me. Horace was intuitive and smart, an A student who shared my curiosity and affirmed my inquisitiveness. When I'd ask why, he'd meet my question with another. "Have you been to the Empire State Building?" he once asked me. Even with all of our families traipsing around the city, Mom hadn't yet taken us to view the Midtown Marvel, completed in 1931. With his eyes dancing, Horace recounted every detail of the structure, which was erected in a race to build the world's tallest building, an honor it held for 40 years until the World Trade Center's North Tower soared higher in 1970. And he was as sensitive as he was bright, his eyes often brimming with tears of emotion when he'd share stories from his boyhood. Our puppy love might have become a full-grown poodle if Mom hadn't cut off its nourishment. One afternoon, Melrose saw Horace and me walking down our street together. I realized he'd noticed us, but thought nothing of it. That changed when later that evening, Mom approached me with a sentence I knew meant trouble. "Come here. I want to talk to you," she said. I took a place at our kitchen table, and she sat down across from me. "Now this Horace Chenery business," she said, "it has to stop. I don't want you seeing him anymore." "I'm not seeing him," I retorted. "What do you mean?" Right then, my brother rolled into the kitchen with his public service announcement. "You and Horace were on 101st Street together today," he said. I glared at Melrose, not sure why he'd ratted me out to Mom. Perhaps out of some annoying instinct to shelter me the way our parents always had. "Well, I live on 101st Street, and so does Horace," I said. "Where else was I supposed to walk?" "You're supposed to walk any place but next to him," Mom shot back. "I don't ever want to see you talking to that boy again." Horace may not have been a minister's son, but he was an upstanding young man, which, as I saw it, should have earned him boyfriend clearance. Mom saw it differently, and in a house more dictatorship than democracy, I knew not to question her mandate. Also, giving her lip would have led to further restriction on my social agenda. I spotted Horace from my window the next day, just as he swung around the corner onto our block. Mom was at work, and Emily and Melrose weren't around, but my neighbor Elizabeth was visiting me. When Horace got close to my building, he looked up and waved at us. Elizabeth, who didn't know Horace and I were sweet on one another, waved back at him and grinned. "You know him?" I asked her. "No," she said, "but I've seen him around here and he's cute." That's when I got an idea. I called out to Horace, shouting for him to wait. Elizabeth and I dashed downstairs and met him in front of the apartment. Out of breath, I scanned our surroundings to be sure Tattle's snitch Melrose and Mom were nowhere in sight. I then turned toward Horace. "I have to tell you something," I said. "What is it?" he asked. "My mother and my brother don't want me to see you anymore," I said, hardly pausing between each word. He frowned. "What do you mean?" he asked. "I can't really explain it," I told him. "I just can't see you anymore." I stared at the ground, and then looked up at Elizabeth. "But I want to introduce you to my friend," I said to Horace. "She's really nice. You'll like her." For a long moment, none of us said anything as the awkwardness of the situation hung in the air. Horace, befuddled and yet clear that there was no more information to be gathered from me, finally spoke. "Well, look," he said to me. "This has nothing to do with us." Then, as the perfect gentleman he was, Horace warmly greeted Elizabeth. I'm sure she'd been standing there wondering what the devil she'd walked into. That was in the summer of 1939. Horace and Elizabeth dated throughout high school and eventually married and raised a family together. Both of them, my maiden crush and my neighbor, are long gone now. And all of these years later, I am left with questions, with specks of wistfulness and regret in the spaces between them. How might my life have turned out if I'd stayed with the beau who'd stolen my heart even as he traced its shape with his thumbs? What if I, rather than my friend, had been the one to marry Horace? What would have happened if I'd defied my mother and secretly followed my inclination? I can only ponder. After Horace had been forced from my world, there entered another young man, someone who, in the view of my mother, was an ideal match for me. Our team of pastors often hosted gatherings in their homes for members, and you'd better believe Mom ensured that Emily and I turned up at all of them. "I'd like you to meet someone," one of the ministers said to me one evening during the party. I stared at the pastor as if he'd just announced the second coming. I was 17 then, but I was no less reserved than I'd been a decade earlier. The pastor nodded in the direction of a young man who approached. "This is my son, Kenneth," he said. I'd of course seen Kenneth around church, but in our large congregation, he and I had never been formally introduced. I smiled and straightened the collar of the velvet dress Mom had sewn for me just for this occasion. I didn't know what to say, which is why I stood there and gawked. Kenneth had a close-cropped fro and dewy chocolate skin, with a smile stretching from ear to ear. He wore a three-piece suit with a row of gold buttons lined up vertically along the vest. At more than 6 feet tall, he towered above me, just as my dear Horace had. While sipping soda, we traded stories. He'd just completed his last year of high school. I was still a student. He was working as a security guard and planned to become a police officer, and his older brother, a lieutenant, was already stationed overseas ahead of the Second World War. I knew absolutely nothing about war, aside from the one that had destroyed my household. Years earlier, Kenneth's mother had died in childbirth, and he'd been raised by his father. He now had his own apartment on Morningside Avenue in Harlem. I still lived under my mother's roof and rulership. Days later, Kenneth came by our apartment. The pastor had told Mom that he'd introduced the two of us, and Mom met him at the door. "So I hear you're the son of a minister," she said with a smile bright enough to light up Times Square. "Yes, Miss Frederica," he said, beaming. And I, recognizing the absolute delight on their faces, knew an unspoken understanding had been reached. An agreement, not requiring my consent. I may not have had much of a voice during adolescence, but I did have aspirations. Given my talent for the piano and organ, I initially thought I'd become a concert musician, a dream my mother birthed on my behalf. My goal shifted the year I was 15. By then, I was taking lessons from a lady by the name of Miss Mann. Her eldest son was the organist at Convent Avenue Baptist Church in Harlem, and I'd sometimes accompany the choir or play for the congregation there. During a concert one Sunday, I played from memory Poet and Peasant a 15-page overture composed by Franz von Suppe. At the close of the piece, when I stood and bowed at the warm applause, I said to myself, I will never, ever do this again. Sure enough, on that afternoon, I walked away from the piano, and it was the last day I set my fingers on ivory. Not only had the Franz piece worn me out, the piano demanded far too much of my time. I'd wake up early to rehearse for 2 hours before school, only to return to that hard bench before bed. All that money wasted, my mother fussed. In hindsight, I'm stunned she let me quit, however insistent I was. Mom continued in her mission to rear us with some culture, and by then, I felt I'd soaked up my share. By age 16, I'd moved on to hairdressing. For years, Mom had her hair pressed by a woman who lived 2 blocks from us, Miss Jones. How on earth can I remember these names? No wonder I have a headache, so many details in my head. After Miss Jones passed, her hot comb got handed down to me. I was good enough at pressing and curling that I turned it into a little business, a way to earn my own money in a house where cash was scarce. On Friday nights, I'd pack my bag with the hot comb and bobby pins and curling irons and begin making my way around to the homes of all the sisters in the church. My road show continued on Saturdays. Then on Sundays, I'd peer out across the sanctuary to see my handiwork on display, in pew after pew of fresh presses and pin curls. Horace had convinced me I was cute, and my hot comb contributed to my vanity. I stayed by the bathroom mirror, running between there and the stove as I laid down my edges and pressed out my bangs. All that primping made me constantly late for class, because no way was I showing up at school with my hair all over the place. I had a different style for every day of the week, from deep waves on Monday to a chignon on Friday. I pressed the life out of my strands every morning, restoring them to order after I'd slept them into a mess the night before. Once when I strode into French class, tardy as usual, my teacher, Miss Burns, lifted an eyebrow. Cicely, why can't you get here on time? She asked. I pointed to my hair. Well, she said, smirking, one day that hair is going to put you on the top of the world. Neither of us could have known just how prescient she was. My shyness began melting away during junior high and high school, but only a touch. In 8th grade, I served as secretary of the student body. I also auditioned for the class opera and was somehow chosen, but I sang so softly during rehearsals that I got fired because I was too reticent to project my voice. Even now, I find it impossible to speak from my core until I find a character's voice within myself. In high school, I was slightly more outgoing, thanks to Horace's loving perception of me. But even in my brief moments of extroversion, there lived a quiet, questioning girl inside. At one point during my teen years, I thought I'd become a psychologist because I was fascinated by people, by what made them do and say the things that they did. I wanted so badly to get inside their minds. But then, clutching a pressing comb, I gradually became more interested in what grew out of their pores. Everyone, including me, predicted that I'd become a professional hairdresser. This was years before acting got a hold of me. And boy, has that allowed me to get inside some heads. Emily also earned her own money. Having inherited our mother's skill as a seamstress, she landed a job at a lingerie factory, sewing gorgeous and expensive slips, underwear, and bras. That's when our arguing began. I'd sneak into her bureau and pull out one of her lacy camisoles, tie it into a knot so it would fit me, or string a ribbon around my waist to cinch it up, and wear it beneath my clothes. After school, I'd race home to shove the camisole back in the drawer before Emily could discover it was missing. She usually caught me, and when she did, an explosion ensued. "Stay out of my things," she'd yell. I'd smile and scamper off, with no intention of keeping my hands to myself. That lingerie was far too pretty to lie there unworn. Melrose worked as well, at any job he could hustle up on the streets. For a time, he had a job at a bagel shop, and in the evenings, once his shift was done, he'd come through our apartment door carrying fresh-baked bagels with an aroma tantalizing enough to pull us out of bed for a taste. In addition to our side hustles, we of course had our chores. My job as resident window washer remained intact throughout my teens. Every weekend, I'd climb through each window opening and balance myself on the ledge with no fire escape or guardrails to prevent me from toppling onto the pavement 5 floors below. Decades later, when that building was named after me, I returned there and stared up at that window in disbelief. I still get chills thinking about all those Saturdays I risked my life in service of spotless glass. Lord Jesus, how did I do it? I could have easily fallen into an urban grave. God literally had my back, just as he does now. My father still lived close by, and I saw him frequently. The year I was 16, my Aunt Zora, Dad's sister, hosted a party with her social lady friends and some family. Dad took me along. The two of us were off in a corner catching up. He had his back up against a chest of drawers, with his arms loosely draped around me as he stood behind me. "Cicely," he said, "why don't you come over here?" I swiveled around and looked at him. "Dad, why are you talking to me like I'm on the other side of the room?" I asked. "Oh, so you think you're the only Cicely in the world?" he said, laughing. He nodded toward a tall, elegant black woman in a far corner. "That's the lady you're named after," he said. As soon as I stepped through our apartment door that evening, I gave Mom the news. "I met my namesake today," I announced. "What kind of foolishness you talking, child?" she said. I told her about my father's confession. "I always knew I wasn't named after no little girl next door," I told her. "I just had a feeling." Mom stared in my direction, but did not speak. "Did you hear me?" I said. "I met the lady I was named after." My mother remained silent. Even after she and my dad had separated, even after he'd raised his palm and bruised her spirit, she never spoke negatively of him to us, other than her occasional reminder that Willie Tyson, as she always referred to him, had refused to accompany her to the hospital when I was born. Despite how my dad had hurt my mother, he was still our father, still the man she insisted we respect. When she did mention my dad's shortcomings, she usually did so indirectly, by folding in his transgressions with all those of his gender who'd been unfaithful. "These men's," she'd say in the plural, "they no damn good." When I recounted the day's happenings for a third time, Mom leaned back in her rocker and uttered a phrase she used often. "You do well," she said, shaking her head. "You do well." That was her way of saying, "So you finally know something you didn't know, huh? Well, good for you. What you're claiming might be true, but I'll never admit it." It was also her way of urging you past an uncomfortable conversation and back to the land of mute. You're dismissed, the end, a period and a closed subject. "You do well. And you'd do best to move on." Kenneth had been on my mother's approved list even before she'd seen him. He checked the only box that seemed to matter to her. He was the offspring of a reverend. At the party, when Kenneth had asked whether he could take me out, I'd agreed, knowing in my heart that he wasn't for me. He was respectful and attractive, but in his presence, I felt none of the magnetism that had pulled me toward Horace. That much I knew. All else, my mother would decide. Urged on by Mom, Kenneth and I began officially seeing one another. One afternoon, he showed up unannounced for a visit. Because I hadn't been expecting him, I was wearing one of my mother's old house dresses. I'd also just unbraided my hair, and it was scattered all over my head. After Kenneth greeted me, I quickly excused myself to tidy up, feeling embarrassed that he'd seen me in such a state. When I returned, Emily had turned on the radio for our daily episode of Amos and Andy. An announcer interrupted the program. "Pearl Harbor has been bombed," he said. I stared at Kenneth, who sat expressionless on the couch. "Did you hear that?" I asked him. "We're at war." Kenneth looked straight ahead, his eyes dazed. "At war?" he finally said. He'd heard the announcer as clearly as I had, but the news didn't immediately sink in. The conflict overseas had at last thundered onto our shores. Not long after, my personal world was likewise overturned. I don't remember everything about the day that permanently ended my childhood, that finished it off with a painful and lasting punctuation mark. The moments I do recall, many of them now dim and faded, unfolded in slow motion. It was late spring, toward the end of my junior year in 1942. With Mom's permission, I'd planned to see Kenneth at his apartment around 4 o'clock that afternoon following school. "I want you home by 7, she said. I nodded and left. This wasn't my first visit to Kenneth's place. Over the months, as he'd charmed my mother with his impeccable manners, with his Ms. Tyson this and his Ms. Tyson that, she'd been increasingly permissive of our spending time together on our own. I think she was more smitten with Kenneth than I'd ever likely be, in love with the idea of our possible future together. Our evening progressed pleasantly, like many others before. We sat on his living room sofa, talking about the news of the day and listening to the radio. After we'd been together for a while, I glanced at my watch, 6:20. "I have to go," I said, imagining the hell I'd catch if I returned home even 1 minute late. I pulled on my jacket and walked to the door. He followed me. "Why do you have to leave so soon?" he said playfully, resting his hand over mine. "You should stay a little longer." I smiled, and he slid my palm off the knob. He turned me around and pulled me toward him, my back resting against the door. He slowly unbuttoned my coat. He then gently began kissing me, first on my forehead, then on my neck, and finally on my lips. As our tongues intertwined, he pulled me even closer, pressing his aroused body into mine, running his palms along my breasts, breathing heavily with desire. Our caressing grew more intense, and he lifted my dress. I recoiled slightly, but before I could back away, he was inside me. He immediately exploded. With my thighs trembling, I looked at my watch again. It was 6:40. "I really do have to go now," I said, straightening my dress and rebuttoning my coat. As I grappled internally with what had just occurred, he and I said nothing, and I left. On the bus ride home, I replayed the scene in my head. Did we just have sex? Is that what that was? I honestly was not sure. Like my period and all other topics of a sensitive nature, Mom had never had a forthright conversation with me about intercourse. I thought of the pregnant woman my friend Fanny Lou had pointed out on the street. Was this how a baby got inside of her stomach? Maybe. but I was not certain. I thought of a photo I'd once seen in a book of a naked couple having intercourse on a bed. Kenneth and I couldn't have had sex, I reasoned. We were standing up with most of our clothes on. And though I didn't fully understand the mechanics of sex, I did sense we'd done something my mother would have prohibited. Maybe this is what she'd meant when she'd told me at age 9, stay away from the boys. A small part of me felt scared that perhaps we'd stumbled across a red line I hadn't known was there. But a much larger part of me exhaled, grateful that I'd stopped short of engaging in what I imagined sex to be, an act carried out horizontally. Nothing could have happened, I kept telling myself. You cannot have intercourse standing up. By the time I arrived home exactly at 7 o'clock, I'd convinced myself I had nothing to be concerned about. Nature had a different take. A few weeks later, when my period went missing, Mom, fearing the likely but praying for the improbable, booked a doctor's appointment. After I'd been examined and given a pregnancy test, the doctor pulled my mother aside in the hallway. Your daughter is pregnant, I heard him tell her through the half-open door. She's probably almost a month along. Silence. In the exam room, my heart hammered away in my chest as my brain raced. Pregnant? How could I be pregnant? Kenneth and I didn't do anything for me to get pregnant. We didn't even lie down. Mom returned to the room and stared at me, aware by my stone face that I'd overheard the doctor. A tear escaped down her cheek. If only you'd waited, she whispered, her voice trembling. And now, dear God, Willie Tyson is going to kill me for his child. After Mom and Dad had separated, my father had often said to her, if anything bad ever happens to my sis, I'll kill you. My circumstance, in the view of my religiously raised parents, indeed qualified as something bad. Their 17-year-old daughter, herself still a child in many ways, was going to become an unwed mother. I sat numb in the cold exam room, vulnerable in my thin blue paper gown and sock feet. I could not comprehend what I'd just been told, just as Kenneth hadn't been able to process that our country was under attack. I'd heard the doctor, and yet the reality of what he'd said felt inconceivable to me, entirely surreal, as if he was talking to some other girl in some other life, while I simply listened in. I dressed as Mom waited in the lobby, sitting side by side on the number 6 train toward home. Neither of us spoke. 7. Ground shifts. Near the close of my senior year, the principal called me to her office. What is this? She asked, holding up a folded paper. I instantly recognized it as an invitation to my daughter's christening and wondered how she'd gotten hold of it. I shrugged. So is it true? She pressed. Do you have a child, Cicely? Seeing no end run around the evidence, I nodded. Yes, I whispered. It's true. She lowered the invitation and sighed. Well, then I'm sorry, she said, but we cannot allow you to graduate from this school. I stood there staring blankly at her, hoping she'd amend her ruling with an exception. But her judgment was final. Only 4 weeks before I was to receive my diploma, just one measly month before graduation, the secret I'd carried beneath my dress had now somehow made its way onto my principal's desk. And as a result, she and the school's administrative staff disregarded my whole senior year and made me repeat that coursework at the school's night program. The year before, when I first learned that I was expecting, The resulting torrent of emotion nearly took me under. I was confounded about how I'd ever gotten into such a predicament and fearful about my path forward. Yet amid the confusion about how I'd become pregnant, amid the immense sadness I felt about how I'd let myself and my parents down, there emerged in me an unmitigated resolve. I would earn my diploma. That was, for me, as much a matter of practicality as it was of honor. I wanted to complete my course and stand proud at the finish line. If I had to keep my belly under cover in order to march across that graduation stage, I was determined to do so. The concealment turned out to be effortless. I had no discernible baby bump at the start of my senior year, nor did I ever develop a large stomach. Before the pregnancy, I'd been a stick at 5 feet 4 inches and around 97 pounds. 6 months into gestation, my belly had grown only to the size of a small cantaloupe, one mostly unnoticeable beneath my clothes. My principal and teachers had no idea I was pregnant, nor did my classmates. My own mother could hardly tell. "That baby must be standing up inside of you," she'd often say. I wore the same A-line button-down dress to school that fall as I wore to the hospital on the day I gave birth the following February. If Emily and Melrose noticed I was pregnant early on, they did not mention it, and frankly, I did not want to talk about it, did not want to acknowledge my shame aloud. Even once they eventually overheard the news from our mother, my sister and brother and I never discussed it. Their sorrowful gazes, from my eyes to my stomach and back to my eyes, said plenty. When you get pregnant during adolescence, you grow up in the space of 2 minutes. In minute one, your feet are dangling from an exam table as you hold your breath and wait. In minute two, all wondering is replaced with reckoning, all equivocating with the definitiveness of the doctor's words. And in that instant, you are no longer a girl, wandering and curious and innocent. You are, by proof of a urine sample and by declaration of a physician, ushered to a doorway labeled parenthood. Through that entrance is an uncertain future, filled with adult anxieties and responsibilities. All at once, your center of gravity shifts from me to us. Your existence is no longer just about you, but rather about this defenseless child who will rely on your strength as a source for his or her own. That is the state I found myself in on the day of my appointment. Half-clothed and glassy-eyed, seated at the corner of life as I'd known it, and a frightening forever. Upon learning I was pregnant, I spent 2 full weeks just trying to figure out how it had happened. Sex, as I'd misunderstood it, necessitated pleasure. What I'd experienced was the swift ascent of my hemline and a 3-second burst of warm liquid. Years later, my friend Maya Angelou would describe her own pregnancy this way. When I was 16, a boy in high school evinced interest in me, so I had sex with him just once, she wrote. And after I came out of that room, I thought, is that all there is to it? My goodness, I'll never do that again. Next thing she knew, she was expecting, which is precisely how I felt. I hadn't even lain down for God's sake, much less experienced any kind of euphoria. I'd been cheated out of intimacy's pleasure ride, yet I was still required to pay its full entrance fee. That is what happens when parents think they're protecting their children by withholding the truth. They are, in fact, exposing them to heartache. There was never any question I'd keep the child. In my family and church community, abortion was not even a thought or conversation. With that consideration off the table, I moved right along to the next, whether Kenneth and I would marry. In many ways, That question had also already been answered, because Mom had long since decided that Kenneth was the one for me. The fact that he and I now had a child on the way simply accelerated that eventuality. Just as my mother had pressed me to go out with Kenneth, she likewise demanded that we marry that December. "I'm not signing any papers for you to marry before you're grown," she murmured. "We'll wait till you're 18. When Maya had first told her mom she was expecting, her mother asked her calmly, "Do you love the boy? And does he love you?" When Maya answered no, her mother said, "Then there's no sense in ruining three lives." If only things had gone that way in the Tyson house. At the time, I experienced my mom's insistence that I marry Kenneth as an extension of her autocracy, her maintenance of a control she felt slipping away. Looking back on it, however, I recognize her behavior for what I believe it was, an attempt to redeem herself, as well as to redirect the plotline of our family's generational narrative. "No unmarried daughter of mine is going to bring a child here," my mother said to me repeatedly. And yet her mother, Mary Jane, had done exactly that. She and my grandfather Charles were not married when they became intimate, and by the time Mary Jane discovered she was pregnant, Charles had been killed at sea, his fishing boat overturned by a violent storm near Nevis. Years later, and a world away, my parents, of course, traded vows. And I'd always assumed they'd done so long before welcoming Melrose. Emily, who sat down one day and did the math, eventually steered me to the truth. My dad and mom married after conceiving my brother. And then, to my mother's heartbreak, her daughter had unknowingly repeated the very familial pattern she'd longed to end. I think now that my mom pressured me to marry not just to spare me a public disgrace, but as a penance for her own and her mother's choices. Her adamance was a kind of peace offering, a way to restore her purity in the eyes of a heavenly father she felt she'd disappointed. I don't remember Kenneth's reaction, or even my own, when I first told him I was pregnant. I'm sure I mumbled it and then devolved into tears, probably backing out of the room as he absorbed the news. My mother's conversation with the pastor, her confrontation of Kenneth, her declaration to him that we must wed, it all feels as illusory to me now as it did in the summer of 1942. Our spirits have a way of dulling the traumatic, of blunting painful memories to lessen their ache. I do recall that Kenneth wanted our child, however unexpected her arrival. I also remember that he never proposed to me. He didn't need to. Our future had been cemented on the evening he'd lifted my dress. Following my pregnancy, the only thing left to do was repent of our unholy act by embracing holy matrimony. I held both of us responsible for our situation, but truthfully, I blamed him more than I did myself. He hadn't exactly forced himself on me, but he had asserted his will in place of mine, let loose on the fertile ground of my ignorance. That is how I felt then. I see now that my perspective was my way of coping with a world upended for us both. I wasn't there when my father heard about my pregnancy. That whole summer, I was so busy hiding from him, as well as from all of the nonsense I knew might occur, that I didn't know who was saying what, or whether Mom broached the topic with him. In an extended family as large as ours, where news spreads more easily than butter on hot cornbread, I knew he'd eventually hear it from someone. If Mom didn't tell him, one of his siblings or cousins certainly would. Which is what happened. I managed to avoid seeing my father for the entirety of my pregnancy. Given that his previously frequent visits came to an abrupt end, it was clear he was avoiding me as much as I was him. Perhaps he was attempting to spare his heart the dagger that would eventually have to land. My first trimester was excruciating. I did not suffer from morning sickness, yet I could not escape a burgeoning sense of remorse. My mother had her way of deepening my regret. Whenever we'd pass a department store window, she'd repeat the refrain she'd first spoken in the doctor's office. "If only you'd waited, sis," she'd say, shaking her head as she eyed the ornate white gowns. "If you'd just waited. If only you'd told me the truth, I'd be thinking." For years, Mom had dreamed of hosting a big wedding for Emily and me, yet she'd been so consumed with the notion of a day, of an elaborate one-time affair, that she'd neglected to explain the basic facts of life. My 18th birthday arrived on December 19th, just after Christmas, and just before the start of my last school term, Kenneth and I took our places at the altar for a small ceremony in our church. His father officiated. My own father did not attend. I learned later that Mom hadn't invited him, and, if I'm honest, I was relieved he wasn't there, thankful to escape his mournful gaze. From the pews, a small group of our family members looked on and wept throughout the service. Everyone cried, tears of lament, disguised as those of happiness. It felt more like a funeral than a wedding. As I stood at the altar in my pale blue gown, my pregnant belly still hardly perceptible, I cried because I did not want to be married. It didn't matter that Kenneth loved me. It didn't matter that he was a respectable young man, which he was. He had not shirked his responsibility to me, to us, to our unborn child. He'd even welcomed our nuptials. And yet, despite how he might have felt or behaved, plain and clear, I was not ready for the commitment. Repeating my vows felt like surrendering my freedom. Just as I was beginning to find out who I was, this marriage placed a chokehold on the discovery. With the exchange of our gold bands and the declaration by the Reverend, I was no longer Cicely the Autonomous. I had become a wife, an underling to be commanded and shepherded. The day after the wedding, I moved out of my mother's apartment and into Kenneth's place. Though I'd relocated, I never truly left Mom's home. Kenneth worked the night shift as a security guard. Since I was so close to delivering, my mother insisted I stay with her in the evenings. She wanted to keep close watch over me, just as she'd been doing since the day I was born. One day in February, after arriving at Mom's apartment, I felt unusually energetic. Powered by my burst of vigor, I cleaned her apartment from stem to stern, pulling down the drapes and pulling off the sheets, throwing everything in the bathtub so I could scrub it clean on the washboard. By the time my mother arrived home from work, I was wiped out. "I think I'll go home now," I told her. "Kenneth is off tonight." "No, you can't go home now," she said, glancing at the clock. "It's after 9. It's too late for you to be out in the streets. You should stay here." Practically before she could complete that sentence, I was laid out on her bed. A couple of hours later, I got up to use the bathroom. When I lumbered back to bed and groaned, Mom awakened. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Well, I have to pee," I told her, "but I can't seem to go." She sat up. "Put on your clothes right now," she said. My sudden urge to clean and to nest, along with the inability to urinate, told her my labor could be imminent. "For what?" I asked. "I said put on your clothes," she snapped. I did as she instructed, and moments later, we were out on a steep stretch of Lexington Avenue, trying to hail a taxi in snow that felt like it was up to our waists. On the icy uphill sidewalk, my mother slipped. There I was, with my pregnant belly and my freezing palms, struggling to pull her up off the ground. Once I did, we still could not find a cab. In the pitch black, we walked for the longest time before finally finding a ride to Metropolitan Hospital. We walked through the doors at 4 a.m. Thus began the wait. Hour after hour, nurses paraded in and out of my room, checking to see how much I'd dilated, as I lay there wishing I'd stayed home a while longer. Finally, at 6:30 that evening when my water broke, doctors began debating the best method of delivery. My birth canal was so tiny, they feared I'd be ruptured when the baby came out. "Let's cut her," I heard one of them say. That was my cue to faint. I regained consciousness just in time to see them taking my daughter out of me. Even before I saw her face, I heard her, because boy, she was already sucking away on that thumb. As the nurses stitched me up, the doctor laid my 6-pound, 3-ounce angel on my chest, her body warm, her head as bald as mine once had been, her heart pattering in sync with my own. Upon hearing I was in labor, Kenneth scrambled from work to the hospital, but didn't make it in time for our daughter's birth. When he did arrive, he came in holding a red tin can of celebratory chocolates, handing them to me with a kiss, and then cradling our baby girl in the crease of his elbow. I stayed in the hospital for 5 days, with Kenneth at my side for much of it. Mom was there as well. "When you were born," she fondly recounted, "those nurses waited on me hand and foot for an entire week. It was the best Christmas I'd ever had, because I didn't have to lift a finger to cook for anyone." As I lay there in bed, nursing my sweet newborn, I likewise relished the sacredness of the pause, the stillness at the start of this thrilling yet terrifying passageway. Mom encouraged me to call my daughter Miriam, the name she'd wanted to give me. I instead gave her a name that I chose, and in these pages, I will call her Joan. Kenneth wanted us to take our daughter home by taxi, but I refused, knowing just how little money we had saved. He'd been working back-to-back shifts, socking away all he could for our family. Yet even with his diligence, we were barely making rent. Soon after Kenneth and I brought Joan home, I finally saw my father. He stopped by our apartment when my husband was at work. One look at my dad's face told me that, without question, he'd known about the pregnancy for months. In his eyes, I noticed not a glimmer of judgment or reprimand, but one of recognition. His string bean, his heartthrob, was no longer a baby girl, but a mother herself. He never addressed my unwed pregnancy outright, abiding by the same rule of silence that had always governed our family. And surprisingly, he also never confronted Kenneth about getting me pregnant. I think my father was more sad than angry. The pain of the situation rendered him silent, not combative. On the evening of his visit, he just looked at me for a long moment, the unspoken truth permeating the air between us. "So what's her name?" he said, smiling and reaching for his first grandchild. "Joan," I said. Subject forever closed. 2 weeks after I'd given birth, I returned to school, my breasts heavy with milk, my resolve to graduate undiminished. By day, I kept my head in a math textbook, while Kenneth cared for Joan until I could race home during my lunch break to nurse her. I'd then pump fresh milk to leave for her in the refrigerator. As soon as the last bell of the school day sounded, I was out the door again, eager to get home to my sweetheart as Kenneth prepared to leave for work. I continued that routine for weeks until the afternoon in May, when my principal cut short my momentum with her discovery. I hadn't planned to christen my daughter right away. I wanted to wait until summer, after my schooling was complete. But of course, my mother replaced my desire with her mandate. Joan would be dedicated during a service at our church that May. My mother planned the whole ceremony and even mailed out the invitations, one of which landed in the hands of a woman my father had previously had an affair with. That woman's son happened to be a fellow student in my science class. He'd been the one to disclose my secret to the principal. On the day I was summoned to her office, it made no difference that I stood within shouting distance of my diploma. What mattered was the school's strict policy. Students were not permitted to indulge in what was considered adult behavior. I'm sure some of my classmates were sexually active, but the proof was in the pregnancy. And once it was revealed that I was a mother, that revelation immediately revoked my status as a student and made that year's credits null and void. Devastating as this news was, I felt undeterred in my quest to earn my diploma. For me, those months were the most painful of my young motherhood. The night campus was all the way down on 18th Street, an hour's ride by train. As much as I yearned to move beyond my mother's rule, I was also desperate for her help, especially since Kenneth worked nights. Together, he and I decided that Mom would watch Joan in the evenings while I attended classes. In the fall of 1943, when Joan was about 7 months old, our grand rotation commenced. I took a job as a part-time clerk, working from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., while Kenneth cared for our daughter. I'd then hurry home to feed and change her before carrying her off to my mother's apartment, where she'd stay until I returned in the late evening. The moment I walked through the door, Joan would begin wailing for me, her arms outstretched from the edge of her crib. How agonizing it was for me to be away from my baby, to hear her weeping when I returned, to see her little face flooded with tears. It is why I often now tell young people to slow down and think, to use protection, to consider what's involved when you bring a human being into this world. It is a heartbreaking thing for children to have children. These kids, they just go off and have babies, and they have no idea of the commitment involved, how their paths will be as irrevocably altered as mine was. Until you are standing in the responsibility of parenting, you cannot truly understand how it shifts your life's terrain. At the close of 1943, I earned my diploma. My precious Joan was nearly a year old, with a full head of thick hair and a laugh that melted me. I had a child I cherished in a life I never planned on. And by God and by perseverance, I had completed high school. As Kenneth and I settled into married life, a road of tedium and regret stretched before me. And when I peered ahead at that path, extending miles into the distance, I felt an enormous urge to retch. The ending to my life story, it seemed, had already been written before I'd even had a chance to live it. I hadn't ever been in love with Kenneth. Our union did nothing to change that. In fact, I had no desire to be married, period, and I'm sure he could feel that. My resentment pervaded our every exchange, spilled over into the long bouts of silence between us. I wanted to do right by our daughter, as well as to be respectful of my husband and our vows. And yet the thought of pretending, of living out my mother's dream instead of discovering my own, felt utterly soul-destroying. When Joan was 2 years old, I left Kenneth. And following the afternoon I cleared out of the apartment, I never saw him again. He, of course, called over to my mother's place looking for me, desperate to know how he could mend whatever was broken between us. I'm sure she must have told him what my actions had made apparent. I was done. Ahead of my departure, I did not tell Kenneth I was leaving the marriage. I knew it would shatter him, and it did. Yet it was a choice I felt strongly I needed to make, and if I'd told him, he would have tried to dissuade me. We did speak by phone after I left, and he pleaded for me to reconsider, begged me to allow him to remain part of our daughter's world. But I was firm in my decision that we separate entirely. Kenneth was a good man, but it wouldn't have done either of us a favor for me to languish in a relationship my spirit could not take. Maya Angelou's mother had it right. I would have ruined three lives. Even as I fled, I knew I was trading one metaphorical prison for another. With no place else to go, I had to return to my mother's apartment. I could not yet stand on my own financial feet, and to Mom's credit, she graciously welcomed me back. But once that short honeymoon wore off, we began clashing. She wanted to do things her way, to raise Joan as she saw best. And I, newly emboldened by my role as mother and head of my family, resisted her domination. Yet because I relied on Mom to look after Joan while I worked, there was only so much arguing I could do. That left me seething internally. Our family doctor recognized my rising blood pressure and mounting stress and mentioned it to my father. Cicely is going to have a nervous breakdown if she stays in that house, he told my dad. You need to get her out of there. After I'd been with Mom for 2 years, Dad heeded the doctor's warning and moved me in with his sister, my Aunt Zora, in Mount Vernon. Between my aunt and other nearby family, my village rose up to help me care for Joan while I pieced together a living for us. On the weekends, or any time I could manage to get off work, I took my daughter everywhere with me, wheeling her around in the carriage I'd splurged on. In the newspapers, I'd seen images of well-to-do London mothers with their fancy buggies, complete with oversized hoods. Though such strollers became scarce during wartime, I would not rest until I hunted down a used one. My determination was not about necessity. It was about gifting my beloved princess with royal treatment. The same sense of nobility and worth my parents had bestowed upon me. When Joan was around 4 years old, I began work as a legal secretary at Sapinsley and Lucas, a law firm at 551 Fifth Avenue. The following year, when she was old enough for kindergarten, I enrolled her in the Little Brown Schoolhouse, a small private school in the Bronx founded by Helen Mead. I could not truly afford it, but I worked overtime and took on side jobs, emptying my financial cupboards in order to cover the cost. I wanted the comfort of knowing my daughter was in excellent hands, that she'd receive an education superior to my own. Nearly all parents I know can sum up their aspirations for their children in one word: better. That is what my mom and dad wanted for me, Emily, and Melrose when they eked out a life for us in the slums. And it is what I wanted for Joan. It is why I rose before sunup to prepare her for school and walked with her, our fingers intertwined, to the bus stop. It's why I worked steadfastly to keep her in that school. The notion of better was the bedrock for my every choice during Joan's earliest years. From the time she was a baby and into her toddlerhood, I treated her like a real-life doll, decking her out in frilly dresses, doting over her as my father had me. No item was too luxurious for my princess, no bedtime story spared. In the land of make-believe child-rearing, that world of pretend parenting, ever on display in the media landscape, dressing Joan up was my way of being the good mom, the ever-present and adoring nurturer. I realize now that it was also my attempt at atoning, of blotting out my past choices with the fresh ink of redemption, just as my own mother had sought to do. 8. Divinely guided. I am a firm believer in divine guidance. Above all, I am God's child, cradled in his unfailing arms, guided by his infinite wisdom. Everything that is happening in my life is unfolding exactly as God has intended. There are no coincidences. Rather, there is a loving Savior who holds my future as securely as he does my life. And at every juncture, he is whispering his will, showing me the way. In 1954, the year I turned 30, I followed the Father's voice down a path that both thrilled and unnerved me. Much on the planet had changed by then. The winter after I had Joan, the Second World War raged on overseas, with U.S.-led forces eventually knocking the opposition to its knees during the Battle of Stalingrad in 1943. That same year, the Tuskegee Airmen, the all-black group of pilots who defied Air Force leaders' belief that blacks were intellectually incapable of becoming aviators, bravely flew their first combat mission in Italy. Here in the United States during that era, the color line showed the slightest sign of fading. In 1944, Reverend Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., then the pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church, became the first black from New York elected to Congress, standing tall for his Harlem community in the House of Representatives. Then, in 1947, Jackie Robinson scored a home run for history when he joined the Brooklyn Dodgers as the first black athlete to play in Major League Baseball. Full equality for our folks was still way off in the distance. But if you squinted real hard, you could see it taking shape. My family had likewise shifted. After Emily finished high school, she'd kept one toe under the roof of our mother and another out on the town with suitors. Her godmother, Miss Cole, eventually introduced her to Reginald, a young man whose family hailed from Nevis. One afternoon, when Reggie stopped in to see Miss Cole's niece, whom he had taken out a few times, he spotted Emily's picture on the wall. "Who is this young lady?" he asked. "That's my goddaughter, Emily Tyson," she said proudly. Noting his salivation, Miss Cole arranged for the two to meet, and I was there on the evening of Reggie's visit. Knock, knock, knock. "Who is it?" I called out, grinning across the living room at Mom and Emily, who already knew, courtesy of Miss Cole, that Reggie would come calling. "It is I, Reginald," he announced in his most proper, put-on-a-show English. I opened the door and in he strode, shoulders square, beret cocked to the left. Lord have mercy, it was the funniest sight. It took all my might to squelch a snicker. Next thing I knew, Miss Cole's niece had gone the way of all flesh as Emily, the charmer that our father had been, swept in and took over Reggie's heart. They courted for a year or so and married. I served as Emily's maid of honor, as well as the resident hairdresser who styled the manes of the entire wedding party. I also designed the bridesmaids' gowns. As Reggie and my sister spoke their promises before a congregation of more than 100, my mother's countenance radiated joy. She had her fairy tale. At last, she had a daughter who'd done things the right way, her way. No one in our family would have predicted that Emily, with her fresh self, would turn out to be the good daughter, the wholesome one, the girl who married before bringing my mother her grandbabies in God's time. There at the altar by her side, I stood balancing my sister's bouquet, forcing a smile for her sake, while shoving down my sadness. However naive I'd been in becoming a teenage mother, however ill-equipped Mom's silence had ensured I was, however enraptured I felt by the miracle of Joan, a part of me still mourned falling shy of my mother's great hope for me. My spirit longed to give her the storybook ending she had craved, the fantasy Emily was now handing to her. We are our mother's children, every one of us. And that umbilical cord connection makes you and me, in ways unconscious and profound, their dream keepers. Though I'd done so unintentionally, I'd allowed my mother's dream, delicate and treasured, to slip from my grasp and shatter at her feet. The fact that we never spoke forthrightly about her disappointment, never dragged that truth out onto the scaffold of our relationship and stood there with it, in no way diminished the pain of its existence for me. Emily's husband, Reggie, was no minister's son, but after the precedent I'd set, Mom had revised her expectations to include any respectable Christian gentleman, whether or not his father was a man of the cloth. Like my father, Reggie earned his living as a produce salesman, overseeing a thriving business selling watermelons door to door. In the summers, Reggie would load his truck with a crop and drive up and down the boulevards of Harlem and the Bronx, scouring for customers while yelling, 15 cents a melon! So admirable was his ambition that it once drew the notice of a prominent businessman who stopped by to make a purchase. After Reggie had talked his new customer into buying not one melon, but three, the man offered Reggie his card. Why don't you give me a call sometime? He said. As it turned out, the man was one of the owners of Filter Queen, a burgeoning vacuum cleaner company. You seem like quite a salesman, he told Reggie. How would you like to sell some vacuums? Sir, Reggie said, straightening his posture, I can sell anything. Less than a year later, Reggie had become a top-earning salesman. He did so well that he and Emily traded their apartment in the city for a home in Mount Vernon. She lived close to our Aunt Zora, making herself and my brother-in-law part of my village in rearing Joan. By the early 1950s, my brother had also settled into a new season. During high school, Melrose had been expelled for fighting and sent to a campus for troubled boys. With the same clenched jaw that powered me through my studies, my brother earned his diploma. Soon after, he moved to Montclair, near our cousins there, and he eventually married a lovely woman by the name of Bernice. For years, Melrose earned a living as a clerk for the post office. If there'd been an award for penmanship, Melrose would have garnered the gold. He had the most gorgeous cursive I've ever set eyes on, with each loop and swirl gracefully rendered. Just as no one would have pegged Emily as the Tyson traditionalist, few would have foreseen that my brother, a restless soul of the streets, would grow into an impeccable scribe. For that matter, only God could have foretold that I, the gullible girl with no idea how periods and pregnancies were connected, would become an unwed mom. I tell you, this life doesn't simply come with its share of unpredictability. Surprise is its most conspicuous feature. Joan sprouted up fast. In those years, I marked time by how well my darling grew. Her care became my singular priority, my all-consuming point of reference. Blurry-eyed and breathless, I sprinted from one daybreak to the next, scrambling to keep the paychecks coming and Joan's tuition covered. During back-to-back shifts at various clerical jobs, I kept my fingertips glued to a typewriter, click-clacking my way to solvency. Late every evening, I'd then crawl my way back to my aunt's place and tiptoe into Joan's bedroom, sitting at her side, witnessing her lost in her dream world, watching her chest rise and